So, if you got the email this week, you got my very provocative subject line. It's Christianity, a nostalgia act. So, I want to talk about this idea of nostalgia, because it's one of those terms that we hear a lot, we say a lot, and maybe we see it a lot. But it's not anything that's new. So, before we kind of get into the faith connections and society connections, I want to just sort of trace the history of it a little bit. So, where are we here? Okay, so nostalgia. So the term has its roots in two Greek words. This is all the etymology we'll get into today, but nostos, which was first found in the Odyssey by Homer, this epic poem from the ancient world, and essentially means homecoming or home. It's related to the idea of home. And then also the word algos, which essentially means pain. So at its root, the idea of nostalgia is this sort of pain that comes from homecoming or a lack of homecoming or a lack of home. Essentially, homesickness is sort of the root of nostalgia. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, the word nostalgia itself was coined in the 17th century by a medical student who is describing sort of the anxieties of these Swiss mercenaries who were fighting away from home. And it was later classified as a medical condition related to melancholia, which is sort of a forerunner, although very different from what we would now know as depression. And so it became this kind of, you know, we think nostalgia is bad now. It was actually a medical condition at one time. So because of that, it became, around that era, where in the 17th century, you're sort of moving into what's known as the Romantic era, which is sort of an era of art and music and literary pursuits and all that kind of stuff that was prominent in the Western world between about 1700 and 1850, so about 150 years. And nostalgia became this major trope of romanticism. Now, not unlike today, if we think about that time frame, 150 years, eras lasted a lot longer back then, I feel like. Before the Romantic era was the early modern era, which was 300 years. Before that was, the medieval era, which was like 1,000 years. So we cut them a little closer now. But anyway, so during that time, 1700 to 1850, you've got a lot of political upheaval. So you've got, obviously, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the expansion of the colonialist effort and all the sort of, you know, horribleness that goes with that. Oh, sorry, I was going to show you this. This is a perfect example of Romantic era painting. This is Wanderer Above the Sea of Fog by Caspar David Friedrich, the German guy. I won't go into all that, but this is just sort of an example. Tim Dick could probably tell you more about it. But I won't make him. I won't put him on the spot. So anyway, so there's all this kind of crazy stuff going on. There's also major technological changes going on at the time with the Industrial Revolution. And so many of the artists of the time, poets, painters, whatever, they were sort of lamenting the shift that was happening in society. So a lot of people were moving to cities, so there was a much more urbanization. And there was also this mechanization of labor. So all of a sudden machines and people sort of being treated like machines. And so a lot of art sort of came out that was nostalgic for the rural life and presenting nature as this kind of ideal human environment that was far from cities and industry. So you kind of see a little bit of that here, right? Here's this guy, lone hero figure out in nature, seeing the world, you know. There's a bit of that. But you also find in the poetry of people like Wordsworth or John Keats, who are very focused on this sort of idyllic nature that we should return to if we want to live as really good humans or whatever. And there was also this idea of the golden age. So this idea of the golden age is important when we're thinking about nostalgia, because it reveals a way of thinking about the past based on idealization and the fallacy that there was ever sort of this perfect time. The idea itself comes from Greek mythology originally. There was all these different ages. The first one was the Golden Age. This was sort of the perfect that was followed by the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, the Heroic Age, and finally the Iron Age, which is where we all live now, in case you didn't know that. This is the Iron Age. Anyway, it reinforces this idea that society is in constant decline rather than progress. And so to correct whatever ails society, we need to look back to learn from the ideal past when things were done better, and so society was better as a whole. We can read this kind of thinking into like the Garden of Eden story. It's very much connected to this sort of nostalgia for the golden age. Now, of course, there's nothing surprising about this. I think we all sort of have this understanding of in our current society, this idea of looking back as better than now. The Greeks and the Romantics were simply expressing on sort of a socio-cultural level what I think all of us experience in our own lives, an idealization or a romanticization of the past, which we, in this sort of version, we construct out of our own faulty memories. So when you think back on your favorite memories, you can do that for a minute. Think back on like a road trip, or maybe high school was your highlight of your life. Was not mine. Maybe it was university, maybe it was like summer camp, whatever. Think about it. And if it's, you know, try and think about a pleasant one. What we do is we tend to form these narratives around these events or times, and then we replay them in our minds, kind of like movies, right? Or we retell the stories over and over again with our friends, and we use this sort of editorial process, which allows us to cut out all the parts that were sort of bad or boring or embarrassing or painful, so that we're left with this nice, tidy story or this set of experiences. So, because apparently I have way too much time on my hands, I sometimes like to sit and investigate those moments in my own life by trying to sort of remember what was going on outside of the established narrative that I've built in my head. And so I think about trips or time. So I think about the hours of boredom that I've spent, you know, in the back of a minivan on a road trip, or in airports, or train stations, or wherever. Just all of that time you spend doing nothing. I think about the many, many petty arguments that invariably follow too much proximity on a road trip, or at a camp, or wherever. The awkwardness of going to a new school. You know, if you ever think high school was the greatest, I always think about the first day of high school and how horribly awkward that was. Or the exquisite agony of the first day of camp. Like, has anyone ever, I don't know if they still do this at camps, but I remember when I would go, it would be like, you get there, you get your cabin assignment, and then you go for a swim test. Did anyone do this? How cruel is a swim test on your first day? You're all standing there in your bathing suits. Yeah, anyway, I don't know who plans these things. So thinking on that, this is a picture I posted to Facebook in March, so a couple months ago. So I put this on Facebook because one day Addy found Jane's old Discman, as you can see from the caption, and all he wanted to do was lay in his bed and listen to CDs. And so we pulled out our CDs, and it made me laugh because he was sort of acting out at five what I spent most of my teenage weekends doing. This was pretty much, it wasn't always on a Discman, I had a stereo, so.
You probably
weren't Well, we dressed him up for the photo, right? Gonna go on pitch, just kidding. Yeah, so this is basically what I spent nearly every dollar I had on CDs back then. And CDs were not cheap, if anyone remembers the 90s, it was like 20 bucks. Great. And I would spend Saturdays in my room listening to music, reading liner notes, thinking about, you know, deeper meanings of these songs, trying to work through my own issues by gleaning wisdom from these rock stars. I don't know if that worked, but... And so, you know, I took this picture of him and I posted this because I was suddenly feeling very nostalgic for this time in my life when I had the time to just sit and listen, right? And I had nothing else that was pressing. And when music was the thing that I did, I just listened to music. It wasn't just something that was on in the background while I was working or, you know, playing in the car. And in my sort of nostalgic hindsight, you know, sometimes I regard those Saturdays as like the best days of my life. You know, I would sleep until noon. I would eat whatever my mom was making. And I never had anywhere to be or anything to do. in contrast to sort of my life now, which is great, but it's full of, you know, family responsibilities, thinking about money for food or bills or mortgage. There's always sort of some project to complete. There's always seems to be something to like watch or read or hear or discuss or whatever. And even in moments where there's sort of all of the immediate things are met, for me personally, there's always this dissertation that I'm writing looming over my head, you know, trying to get that done right so I can graduate. And then, of course, beyond that, there's the anxiety around not finding a job, you know, being a failure, being an embarrassment to my family, you know, and the fear that maybe I should have just stayed in that unfulfilling job that I didn't really like, but it was easy. And always around the corner, of course, is the cold realization that one day I will die. Within a few decades, no one will remember that I existed. But perhaps I'm spiraling here. The point is that I think back on those Saturday afternoons, and I think teenage Tim did not have any of those worries. I don't actually know how old I was in this picture. I know I got that guitar when I was 18, so it's somewhere around there. This guy just had to worry about how he was going to get another $20 to buy the next Radiohead album, right? That's all it came down to. But if I really think about those days, and I sort of investigate beyond the narrative that I've crafted, the reason that I had so much time didn't have very much to do with personal choice. The reality was, I wasn't a person in high school, especially with a lot of friends, so if my like two or three closest friends were busy, I was kind of out of luck. I was too young to drive, and even when I could drive, I had to share a car, so I didn't always have that. And in the winter, my bike, of course, was out of commission. There were no iPhones or iPads. There was no limitless access to content. My family had two TVs, and because I was the youngest child, I often had to cede the remote control to my older brothers. I have an oldest brother who always watched golf on Saturdays. I don't know if he just did it to annoy me or what, but golf every Saturday. My room was the only sort of place that I had any privacy. And my stereo and my collection of CDs was the only thing I had complete control over. So I would sit there in my teenage angst, frustrated that girls in general, and a few specifically, didn't, you know, like me.
No.
Yeah. that I could never be as cool as the rock stars I listened to or the guys in the movies. That I didn't have more friends with cars or friends in general. But for some reason, in the narrative of those times that I replay in my head, you know, I only retain the music and the freedom and the beauty of a lazy Saturday afternoon. A similar thing kind of happens when I think back. I didn't discuss this with her, but when I think back of our first summer being married, Jane and I, way back when, we had this sort of awkward situation where within a few months of being married, we both lost our jobs. And so luckily we had a lot of leftover wedding money and pretty good income tax return that year, so that we were able to, you know, stay afloat for the summer. We were living downtown, so we bought some cheap bikes, and we lived this life of leisure for a few months. And so whenever we reminisce about those days, we've established a sort of narrative about how great it was to have all this time in our early marriage just to be a couple. And that was great in a lot of ways. But we also sort of conveniently have written out all the times that I would log into our bank account to make sure that there was enough money, you know, just to check our dwindling savings account. The many, you know, dinner invitations we had to turn down because we couldn't afford to eat in restaurants. The many, many pieces of paper filled with addition, but mostly subtraction to make sure that we could pay the rent every month. The arguments over my needing time to write my master's thesis. And this mix of embarrassment and appreciation that came whenever our parents would come over and drop off some extra groceries they didn't need. And then there was this Cold War-like standoff we had one time when Jane insisted that we had to buy bike helmets if we were going to have bikes. But we don't always talk about that. So anyway, all of this, we also went to New York that summer. That's in New York. So we were doing fine, but complicated. Nostalgia, just like nostalgia. Anyway, all of this is simply to point out this fallibility of memory, and in turn, the sort of fallacy of nostalgia for some better time. So if you listen to journalists or commentators on the internet right now, you get the feeling that we live in this particularly nostalgic time, at least in terms of our mass entertainment. So shows like Stranger Things, Goldbergs, and The Americans, are these shows that are mostly pretty standard genre pieces, but they draw these sort of additional cool points by engaging with nostalgia, or engaging nostalgically with an 80s aesthetic. So by engaging nostalgically, I mean that Stranger Things, for instance, I'm just singling it out because it's a good example, it's not exactly an accurate representation of what the 80s were really like, but rather it's a pastiche of the 80s built out of sort of the creator's memories, as well as Spielberg movies, John Hughes movies, Ghostbusters, The Goonies, and Stephen King novels, sort of all mixed together. And you can see that, I put these next to each other because you can even see in the sort of advertising art this throwback to an 80s aesthetic where there was like this focus on painting, which in itself was a throwback to 40s aesthetics. So the first one I think was probably Star Wars, which had this painted poster, which was a throwback to these sort of like Buck Rogers or, whatever. Different sort of 1940s aesthetics for how you made poster art, which was different than what's being done in the 70s. And so because like the things that they're drawing from were not accurate depictions of the times in which they were created, but rather, as most popular art is, idealized or at least stylized versions of their times, what results from paying homage to these artifacts is that Stranger Things becomes a celebration of how artists in the 80s idealized their own time. So just like my teenage memories, or the idyllic version of the first year of our marriage, the pleasant things rise to the surface and form the nostalgic narrative of a time when things were supposed to be, or where things were great, as opposed to the present, where we have all these sort of problems that we can't ignore, and so the present never feels as great as the past. And so, by the way, this is no way a critique of Stranger Things or any of these shows. They're great. I'm just singling it out because I think it's a good way of thinking about how nostalgia works, right? And because the show is, and a lot of these shows are, as they say in the music business, a nostalgia act. So what do I mean by a nostalgia act? Do we know that term? Have you ever heard that term? Is it too insider baseball? No? Okay. So a nostalgia act, the best example would be to think about the Rolling Stones, okay? So the Rolling Stones, when they go out on a tour, you know, and they pick their set lists and all that, they're not playing obscure things like 2000 Man or Monkey Man from Let It Bleed. You know, does anyone even know those songs, right? They're great songs, by the way, but they would never play them, right? They go out there and they play the hits. They play Start Me Up and Sympathy for the Devil, You Can't Always Get What You Want. The list goes on and on. Because that's what people want to hear. That's what gets the crowds going. And the concert becomes a reminder of why people love the Stones. Because when you compress a 50-plus year career into 2 hours, they come across as the greatest band in the world. And that's the draw of the Nostalgia Act. Relive the great parts, forget the bad, and add in enough of something new, so like sound system, big light show, TVs, all that, maybe a younger guitar player, and you give this illusion of novelty. And you've got yourself a sold-out tour when you do that, right? So transfer these elements to a TV show or a movie. You give people a familiar story pattern, add in some higher production values that people might be used to seeing, mix in some nostalgia for the time when your target audience were kids or teenagers, add in some binge-worthy elements to make sure your viewer never leaves his or her couch, release it all on the same day so that you can capture the cultural conversation for a week or so, and you've got yourself a successful nostalgia TV act. And, of course, there's nothing new about this formula, despite the mountains of articles that get written seemingly every day about how we live in this nostalgic time. Back in the 90s and through the aughts, we had, that 70s show, Boogie Nights, Neo Disco, all the bands, like The Strokes, The Vines, The White Stripes, The Killers, The Hives, I could go on, who were drawing from 70s rock and punk. In the early 90s, we saw a revival of the 60s, right? Does anyone remember the movie Forrest Gump? Or the Beatles anthology, bands like Weezer, Beck, sort of drawing on this 60s aesthetic. The 70s and 80s, we're always looking back to the 50s. I'm sure anyone who's here four weeks ago, remembers the Grease thing that Tim Platt showed, right? Grease was big. American movies like American Graffiti, TV shows like Happy Days, a movie like Diner. If you remember the Hangout restaurant on Saved by the Bell, had this very 1950s aesthetic. Uncle Jesse's Elvis obsession on Full House, the movie Back to the Future, right? This is all calling back to the 50s. If we go back further, the tumult of the 60s was a major boost to the careers of people like Frank Sinatra and his crew, even though they were from much earlier. Filmmakers like Peter Bogdanovich, Martin Scorsese, Woody Allen, Spielberg, George Lucas, they all got their ideas from sort of mashing together classical Hollywood tropes with sort of European or other world cinemas to make experimental cinemas to make these movies. You know, we think of Star Wars now as a nostalgia act, right? So you put out a new movie every 6 months, calling back to Star Wars. But Star Wars, the first one, was a nostalgic movie, right? It was this combination of early film serials, and if you ever want to know where George Lucas got the story for Star Wars, there's a Japanese film called Hidden Fortress, which is the same story. Also, you know, just all of these things kind of combining, along with the writing of this guy named Joseph Campbell, who wrote this book called Hero of a Thousand Faces, which pointed out that nearly every hero narrative is exactly the same, and that all kind of came together for Star Wars. So we're now in this age where we're nostalgic for a movie that was nostalgic for the past as well. Anyway, it all comes around. And I can keep going, by the way. In the 50s, Hollywood was obsessed with the 20s. They were adapting modernists like Hemingway into big movies. They were remaking silent era films like Ben-Hur. And they were rewriting their own history in films like Singing in the Rain, if anyone's ever seen that. In the post-World War II era, there was movies like It's a Wonderful Life, The Magnificent Ambersons, Life of Father, and they recreated this innocence of the early 20th century to remind audiences of a simpler, more wholesome time that didn't, you know, in the wake of World War II when people sort of needed that. They were seeing what sort of horrible things were happening. The movie Gone with the Wind, which is still the highest grossing film of all time if you adjust for inflation, came out in 1939, and it's a nostalgic interpretation of the American Civil War and Reconstruction period. And I can go back even further. The first blockbuster ever recorded, 1915's Birth of a Nation, which is an egregious and blatantly racist Civil War retelling, was, you know, as well a nostalgia act. Okay. And interestingly, if you think about the time gap between, say, the Civil War happening and that movie coming out in 1915, is about the same distance in time as like when Mad Men came out about the 1960s, right? So you would have had people in the audience in 1915 who maybe had fought in the Civil War, or at least were alive when it was going on. So it's an interesting compression of time that way. Anyway, that's just a side note. So I won't go back any further. I could, because we already talked about Romanticism. You can talk about Shakespeare. You can talk about the ancient Greeks. They're all doing the same thing, right? Human beings are a nostalgic bunch, and that comes out in our artistic endeavors. So, but I'm not bringing this all up to dump on nostalgia. You know, I find myself a very nostalgic person, as we've already seen. Not always for my own time, but I'm sort of nostalgic for this time before I was born. Ramona caught me in a MCC this week buying two rotary phones. Or one wasn't rotary, one had button. But we need a new phone for the house, so we bought these. Yeah. So, you know, and just this week, Addie asked me why I only like black and white movies. So I'm clearly a person who likes to sort of travel to the past a little bit through media. However, I think as much as I like to do that, I think it's important to be aware of the fact that nostalgia is, at its root, fictional. Especially as the lines between sort of fact and fiction continue to blur, as the collective discourse continues to splinter in this people are calling post-truth world, where influential features can discredit reality for their followers, using catchphrases like fake news, as they evoke a sort of amorphous and enigmatic golden age when things were great, while promising to go a way back to this imaginary time. That's all I'm going to say about that guy. You can guess who I'm talking about. But the reality is that there was no golden age, right? I don't think this is earth-shattering. If you pick any era, you will very quickly find reasons why it wasn't so great. You know, I always think of like Paris in the 20s, right? Cheap rent, cafe society, great art. But there was also, you know, no air conditioning, no antibiotics. The Spanish flu was wiping out millions of people. There were things like polio. You know, the reality of the time is not as nice as the glamorized version. I can remember another time, I was watching a lot of Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movies. People know who that is. These movies from the 30s. And I remember saying, Jane and I were watching them, and I remember just saying to her that I thought it would be so great to live then in the 30s, right? Now, if you know anything about 1930s Hollywood movies, they're notoriously out of touch with what was happening in 1930s America. There's nothing of the Depression or, you know, this sort of systematic and state-sponsored racism. All of that gets excised from these narratives, which are sort of then filled with elegance and class about the wealthiest people. And they have, you know, no more basis in reality than, say, we're talking about Spielberg. You know, if you ever watch the movie E.T. and you see the way that family lives, there's no reality to that suburban life that they had. I don't know how a single mother could have afforded a house like that. Anyway, but that's fine, right? This is how we create art. So, and sort of as we were having this conversation, I don't know if Jane will remember this, but she sort of remarked that, you know, as a woman of color, she would have been lucky to even get a job as a servant in one of these houses of, like, the characters that we're seeing. And so for me, that was this really big reminder of kind of my own white privilege. You know, that's these reminders that aren't always welcome but are very necessary. And just realizing that, oh yeah, there's space in these movies for someone who looks like me, but not someone who looks like you. Which I think is important to realize as well. So, I want to try and tie this all back to church, because that's where we are. And because in many ways, as I said, Christianity today is sort of a nostalgia act. And I shouldn't say today, because I think it's always had that at its roots. Large portions of the church are engaged with looking back to an imaginary past where things were better. So here's a graph, which can be read with despair or not, depending on your spiritual view. This is not a very good graph. If you'll notice, it's completely lacking in any sort of information here on the y-axis. So this could be like 10 people to 2 people, for all we know, right? But this is the sort of graph that you will find when you Google church attendance since 1950 or something like that. And it shows up on all sorts of blogs. And it sort of, it points out, and it's usually on blogs that are lamenting the decline of church attendance in I think America, again, I don't know, there's not a lot of information on this thing, but I found it on at least 3 or 4 blogs, so I thought I'm going to throw it up here, because it's part of the conversation. So now oftentimes what will also happen is graphs like this will be linked to other social phenomena, so depending on the blog, crime, racial intolerance, abortion, LGBT rights, divorce, school shootings, in order to make a sort of argument, and notice I use the word phenomena because I don't feel that all of those things are problems, just to point out, but some websites do. But they link these to a decline in Western civilization being directly correlated to people not going to church anymore. It's a very broad logical leap that you have to make. But the argument is that if people went to church the way that they did in, you know, 1952, the world would be more like it was in 1952, which is a sort of curious desire. So there's obviously lots of major flaws in that argument. The world, whether people go to church or not, is not the same as it was in 1952. Technology, social structures, government policies, attitudes about race, gender roles, the entire notion of gender as a construct, sexuality, nationality, education, child-rearing, war, violence, and guns, all of these attitudes have changed in significant and irreversible ways. In some ways, in some cases, the changes have been destructive, but in other cases, the changes have been for the better, especially if you're of the opinion that for people to be successful and fulfilled, it's best if they can be who, be with, be how they feel most comfortable, rather than being forced to conform to a set of rules or expectations dictated by what is or what has been sort of a typical expression of personhood. So, for example, in 1952, it was not okay to be black in many churches. In other churches, it was okay to be black as long as you stayed in the back. In other churches, even if it was okay to be black, it was not okay for you to marry someone that was white. In certain parts of the United States, it was perfectly acceptable to be part of a lynch mob on Saturday night and to be in the pew or even the pulpit on Sunday mornings. In 1952, it was not okay to be lesbian, gay, trans, or pretty much anything that didn't conform to cultural norms of the time. It was also not okay to be a woman if you wanted to have any sort of leadership role beyond, you know, Sunday school teacher. So there's this paradoxical notion that to get to some sort of future utopia, we must return to a nostalgic version of the past. The problem is, of course, that both of those places are imaginary. The future hasn't happened yet, and the past cannot be returned to, especially if that past is a construct created out of faulty memories and wishful thinking. But this moving backwards to arrive at the future colors a lot of what has become of sort of Christian theology and thinking. So I'm not going to break down the complex and cryptic nature, you know, of like the Book of Revelation, because, you know, we all want to have lunch eventually. Except to say that, sort of, to acknowledge the sort of general accepted trajectory of the narrative in sort of Western evangelical Christianity, and that narrative is sort of that we're headed to some sort of cosmic showdown where everything will be destroyed and rebuilt. So this idea of the coming of the new heaven and the new earth. And in a lot of the sort of interpretations of that idea, what we're essentially is going to happen is sort of a return of this Garden of Eden, right? This Christianity's version of the Golden Age. So the idea is that all humanity happens, all of human history, all of cosmic history happens so that God can eventually sort of hit the reset button and go back to his first idea, which, in case we've forgotten, was a failed experiment, if we take that story. So if, according to the story, Adam and Eve didn't stay in the garden because God had given them free will, and they chose to disobey. So in this new Eden, you know, if we're taking this kind of idea, what's to say that humans won't mess it up again? Unless in this version, free will has been removed from the equation and people are, you know, just content to live like robots, which seems contrary to what God set out to do. But, you know, that was the story that I was told. It's probably the story a lot of us were told. That, you know, sort of when all is said and done, whether we end up, you know, so this idea of heaven in the afterlife, or we live on this new future earth, or whatever other ideas abound, things are going to be very different, very orderly, kind of very fascist in the end. And so, you know, and I can remember wrestling with this idea even as a young kid, because I remember thinking, being just as worried when I thought about the afterlife of going to heaven as going to hell, because, you know, sure, hell had fire and all that kind of stuff, but heaven sounded like those never-ending church services that I just wanted to escape all the time. I can remember being at Rock Lake once, lying on the ground because I was in this worship service for 3 hours probably, and just thinking, if this is heaven, count me out. But anyway, so this all grows out of this idea that the present is so bad that the future has to be better. And it seems like since the past was pretty great, our solution is to just graft the past onto the future. So we're all going to live in a beautiful garden. The animals will be able to talk to us, apparently. There'll be just one rule, and it'll be really easy not to break, unless you're those jerks, Adam and Eve. And we'll all have a great suntan, because we're going to be naked all the time. So this is the future. Now, we're talking about things that happen. I'm sort of gone off on like a really big cosmic, eschatological level. That's sort of far beyond any of our pay grades. Let's try and move down to a more practical level. So, because we do the same sort of thing sort of in the day-to-day. Okay, so we see the problems of the world, and we see a graph like this, and it all seems pretty simple. When people were more Christian, the world was a better place. So, if we just force people to conform to our way of thinking, our being not necessarily us in this room, but our as a collective Christian idea, If we force people to conform to our way of thinking, everyone will be better off. We'll ignore all the horrible things that happened back then, we'll accentuate the positive, and create a tidy narrative for all those lost souls to adhere to. So maybe I'm cynical, but it strikes me that this is sort of the distillation of the entire kind of evangelical movement or experiment. This is the reason that people like Billy Graham in the 60s didn't want to get involved with the civil rights movement. He figured if he could just make everyone Christians, racism wouldn't be a problem anymore, since true Christians could not be racist. I don't know if anyone told him about what was going on around him in the South, but clearly those true Christians could be very racist. So, you know, it's a problem. Now, unfortunately, or fortunately, that's not really how things work. There's no way forward that leads through an imaginary version of the past. We see this in business. You know, what companies thrive? They're the disruptors, the ones who break all the rules. We see this in nature. Species that survive are the ones that can evolve new methods of surviving in an ever-changing environment. So growth is messy, and it's hard work. So I'm going to jump back to that song from the beginning. And as I said, there's a lot of strange things, but these couple of lines are really interesting to me. So I think that the songwriter, the speaker in the song, is sort of grappling with these ideas, how to sort of move forward, struggling with norms and that kind of stuff. So in verse 2, you have this interesting sort of line where he says, I hurry about shame, and I worry about a worn path, and I wander off just to come back home, turning the waltz, a high and a low wind. So there's this idea of, like, he's worried about the worn path, that maybe this path, you know, the way things have always been done isn't all that great, but there's also this hurry about shame. So leaving the path leads to this idea of shame. And even with all that, they're still wandering off just to come back home. And then this idea of turning to waltz, right? What is a waltz but a very formulaic set of dance steps, right? It's not, you know, free-flowing interpretive dance. There's a very much a, you know, 1, 2, 3 steps you got to follow, things you got to do. You can improvise within it, but you got to stay within the parameters. And so then he comes back in the third verse and sort of makes this allusion to nature. So what a river don't know is to climb out and heed a line, to slow among roses or stay behind. So this idea that a river, this natural force that shapes, you know, continents and lands and all that, doesn't have this feeling. It doesn't know to climb out and heave the line. It flows where it flows. It doesn't slow among roses or stay behind, right? And so it's this allusion to this idea that change, that moving forward is messy and inconvenient. And so rivers are inconvenient. I mean, look at the layout of our city, which has been built around a river. It's inconvenient, right? But it doesn't care, because that's the way it's gonna get where it's going. And that's the way that societies progress. They don't progress by following the old ways, because we don't live in those old times. And I think that it's interesting because Christ clearly understood this as well. I mean, when you look at the Gospels, how many times is this phrase come up? You've heard it said, but I say. So he didn't show up to sort of reinforce these old norms. He came around to disrupt. He came to cut through all of these dogma and rules to get back to that original connection. But he did it in a way that didn't exclude free will, that didn't require membership in a specific tribe, that didn't force humans to be disconnected from their humanity. So when we attempt to retrofit our spirituality, or worse, someone else's spirituality, in order to conform to the ideals of the past, we stifle that spirituality. So, and it gets even worse when we don't acknowledge the problems that spirituality caused in the past by simply focusing on the pleasant parts, right? We take this nostalgic view. We create narratives that say that women were happy being characterized as servants and as secondary to men. Blacks were happy in their separate sections or their separate churches. Children were never abused by pastors or priests because I never heard about it. The LGBTQ community wasn't a problem because people didn't choose to be gay or trans back then. Everyone stayed on the worn path, Everyone knew the steps, and they danced the waltz. And if people stepped out of line, we weren't responsible for loving them anymore, because they were nothing but sinners, and they were going to hell. Does this sound like a familiar... Yeah. And it was fine if you were on the inside. Like the way my whiteness put me on the inside of those Fred Astaire movies. Like this one. But it doesn't take long, if you're looking around, to find someone you love on the outside. Held out by walls that, despite being mostly fictional, still cause division and a lot of pain. So, we're going to do one more thing. We're going to have communion together. And I'm going to play something to sort of just have music as we share communion. This is, it's actually a poem by a guy named T.S. Eliot. He was a poet in the early 20th century. And it's called Ash Wednesday. And this is just sort of the last part of Ash Wednesday. And so this is actually him reading it, so his voice is very strange. But I put the words on there too, so you can kind of read them. And it has this idea of looping around and coming back to where he started and sort of fighting the inertia of all of those sorts of things. So just, I'm not going to break it down, just kind of experience it as we take communion together.
Rocks, our peace in his will, and even among these rocks, sister, mother, and spirit of the river, spirit of the sea, suffer me not